for putting together this very inspiring workshop. I think it's quite refreshing to have a foundational workshop on topics that are not the usual foundational topics that we would normally discuss. So I tried to do my best to give a talk that it would not be my usual talk, although I couldn't help talking about purification even in this one. So this is a very recent work that just appeared today on the archive, just because there was the talk and I wanted to have it ready. And it is about defining subsystems. So it's a kind of a very, very specific question that you may ask. So having dividing the world into subsystems, so then partitioning the data that we get from our experiments in data associated to subsystems, is a very fundamental primitive in the scientific method. But if you think carefully, you can ask, like, how do we do that? I mean, we usually rely on an existing theory that already has subsystems defined there. And the question is, how do we define subsystems when we have a generic theory that is not necessarily a theory that has a subsystem from the beginning? So what we have, what we had in foundation in the past years, were that subsystems were taken as a primitive notion in many of the frameworks that have been studied by different authors, well, including myself. I think one of the first areas in which the point that composing subsystems together is a primitive notion of the theory, I think the first area in which this was acknowledged explicitly was the area of categorical quantum mechanics, introduced by Abramsky and Cook and so much developed in the past 15 years. So that was really the point where the awareness of the importance of composition, as far as I know, came into quantum foundations. And we have been also developing frameworks for reconstructing quantum theory and for studying information processing in general theories. And this was the framework of operational probabilistic theories, where you start from the composition as the very primitive notion of the theory. This was also related to work that Lucien Hardy did in this formalism locality notion. And these are kind of notions that have been very important in the past years. I would say, actually, I'm still very fond of this approach. And if you ask me in normal times, I would advocate strongly that we should follow this idea of starting with subsystems and composition as a primitive notion. However, in this talk, I will not do that, and I will explore another way of doing things. So just to contrast the frameworks, so in the compositional framework, you start from day one with an operation that takes pairs of systems and joins them into subsystems. This is what the monoidal structure of categories would do. It would give you a tensor. And whenever you have a big and large system, this system comes already with a preferred decomposition into subsystems, because that's the way you built it from the smaller system. However, in some cases, it's interesting to have the flexibility to choose how to define your subsystems in a way that is not predefined by the structure of the theory. And there are lots of examples, of concrete examples of that in physics. One example, I would say the primary example, is quantum field theory, where you start with just one system, like the field, as a monolith of a monolithic system that you study that is spread here and there. And then you start defining subsystems. So you partition the field into subsystems that would be the modes. So this could be spatial modes, temporal modes, momentum modes, or subsystems associated to local regions in space-time. So there are many, many ways to partition the field into subsystems. And this is not specified from the beginning from the theory, but it's something that you can do after you have the field. Another kind of another example closer to quantum information is the theory of quantum error correction. When you have a certain model of your noise, the noise that affects the system in the lab, and you can define, based on the Krauss operators of the noise, you can define some virtual subsystems, some noiseless subsystems, where the noise does not act. And this is important because if you can, you would surely encode your information in those subsystems. And those subsystems typically have nothing to do with the original partition of the systems into qubits, but they are kind of induced by the particular type of noise that you have. So the aim of this talk is to do something similar to what was done practically in quantum error correction and quantum field theory in the case when we have a generic theory. So we would have a generics theory that starts with a global system, and our job is to find a way to identify subsystems within the global system. Just to look more carefully into the quantum case. So if you look in quantum theory, the canonical way to define subsystems is to associate them to operator algebras. So you take matrices or operators on your Hilbert space, take algebras of them, and you associate the systems to the algebras. So the easy example is the one when you have a tensor product Hilbert space. You have a Hilbert space H that is the product of HA tensor HB. And then you consider the operators that act only on A and are tensored with the identity on B. So they define an algebra of operators. You can sum them, multiply them, take the complex conjugate, take the dagger. You can do all these algebraic operations. And from this notion, you can define the local system A, that would be the system, let's say, of Alice, where Alice can work on and would describe her lab. So that's probably the easiest example. Another example is the one of quantum error correction that I mentioned before. So you have a noise, you have a map with the Krauss operators, you build an algebra out of these operators, and with this you will have a partition of the system into subsystems. You can choose the noiseless ones. And a more more glorified example is the example of local algebras in quantum field theory. Again, you would have an algebra associated to a region, an algebra of observables. That's the approach of Rudolf Hag and the school that followed from his work. So you have these algebras, and the algebras are really used to identify the local regions where you can act. Okay, so all of this has been the inspiration for the work I'm presenting, except that there is a little problem, that operator algebras are a very quantum notion. If you go outside quantum theory, it's not clear at all what it means to multiply two observables, right? I mean, observables are things that are typically related to measurements and to the statistics of measurements. What does it mean to multiply two measurements? So that's what I'm writing here. So all these quantum notions are typically based on the fact that observables can be multiplied. And in general theories, or at least the general theories I'm used to, I don't have a multiplication of observables. So it's interesting to ask the question, how can you define subsystems in a theory that has a more operational flavor, where you don't ask this question about multiplying observables? Yes, please.
Good question. In your example of the noise operators, the things that were being multiplied aren't observables, they're cross operators.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. So yes. Do you have any
general theories you also have?
No, sorry, yeah, I've been a little bit liberal with the use of the word observables. As people are usually, because when we say observables, like here we really mean any operator on acting on A. So typically in standard quantum mechanics, we think of the self-adjoint operators are like describing the measurements we can do. In the algebraic framework, people are kind of more liberal and consider every operator. So the Krauss operator in this sense would have the same role. So yes, if we say observables, we typically mean something slightly more restricted than that. This example perhaps is good that you brought this up, because in this example we are not even talking about things that could be interpreted as observations. They are really plain operators acting on the Hilbert space. So yes, that's a good clarification. Thanks. So yes, we want to see how to define subsystems in general theories, and why would we be interested in doing that? Well, there are at least a couple of reasons. One, for those who care about quantum axiomatizations, about axiomatizing quantum theory, and we had several axiomatizations so far, those axiomatizations were pretty much based on the compositional framework, where you have a composition of systems from the beginning. The interesting thing is that if we have a broader definition of subsystems, something that is more general than what we had before, the axioms that we imposed on the systems in our theory will become more powerful, because there is a more broad range of applicability of the axioms. So it could be that we could get away with axiomatizations that have less axioms, maybe axioms that are more loaded of meaning than the ones that we had so far. So it is a way to concentrate the axiomatic ideas into fewer axioms and displace some of the work to the definitions. Okay? So that's part of the motivation to do that. And in a sense, some of the things I will say in this work will go in that direction. Not in a particularly exciting way, in a very plain way, but still I think this is something that we, for which I can also make the case in this talk. So another thing I was saying is that some of the old axioms that we considered in the quantum axiomatization could also become easy consequences of the definitions, and that's really pretty much the thing I was talking about, the thing we will see in this talk. So the other thing is that the obvious thing is that if you have a more general definition, this gives you a broader perspective even on quantum theory and on the things you already know. So even if you don't care about doing quantum axiomatizations, having a kind of cleaning up the definition of subsystem and making it more abstract is generically useful for even for the practical purposes of studying quantum information, quantum field theory, and other things. So that's the motivation. So, yep.
What is really the role of operators, or of the fact, ability to multiply operators? Because is this really necessary to define them? I always thought this is just something that comes out because we are used to talk about observation as an algebra.
Yes.
This structure as an algebra, for example,
yes.
I mean, multiplication of operators or of observables doesn't really have an operational meaning. So
no, that's the point I was making.
Okay.
Yes.
So, is this really, I don't see where it really enters.
Well, it does enter in the definitions we know. If it is necessary, or at least I would say in most of the definitions we know, there are cases where you start just from a set of operators and you define subsystems like Barnum, Viola, and Neil have worked on this. But still, even there is the algebra on the background. You start from a set, but then you look at the commuting operators, they will form an algebra, and then you take the double commutant and you end up
having.
So in quantum theory, we really have this strong algebraic structure there. I'm not claiming it's not necessary, because, I mean, on the contrary, the point of the talk is to show that one can try to do things in another way, but I would say it is canonical. It's the way we have done things so far most often and most successfully, I would say. So there is previous work on this, as I was already anticipating. I think the first work that tried to go beyond quantum theory and define subsystems beyond quantum theory was this work by Barnum, Ortiz, Somma, and Viola. So they had previous work within quantum theory on this notion of generalized entanglement that is pretty much entanglement associated to sets of operators, sets of observables. I give you a generic set of observables, you have a construction, you can talk about how this some sort of system associated to this observable is entangled with another part of the system. But in this particular work, they generalized this to a framework of convex operational theories. So this is a very interesting work with an algebraic flavor again, but in the framework of operational theories. I will not follow that much this direction. Whereas I will follow quite strong, closely the work that was done by Lydia, Lia, and Renato when they defined the notion of resource theory of knowledge. So it's the idea that we describe our knowledge with sets of possible states, and the way we partition the sets defines the objects that we consider. So that idea was present already in that work, but was further developed in the thesis by Lia. And it is available in this paper on operational locality in global theories. So again, this is this is very, very close to the ideas I'm presenting here, and some of the constructions that I will give have appeared in this paper, actually. So that's the direction in which I will go, and the direction is to try to associate the subsystems to set of operations that agents can do. So the idea is to associate the subsystems to the operational capability of the agents. So if you have a good lab, you will have a certain subsystem. If you have a lousy lab, you will have another subsystem that is more coarse-grained and with less states, with less capabilities. So that's pretty much the philosophy that I will follow in this talk, and it was anticipated in these two works. Also, there is a previous work that is pretty much on a completely different topic and with a completely different philosophical outlook that was by Gilles Brassard and Paul Raymond Robichaud. And this was about defining a sort of noumenal and kind of ontic states of the world and associate them to to the states that we describe in quantum theory to make predictions. And besides the philosophical intentions of the paper, there is a very nice construction of equivalent classes of dynamics that is actually something that will surface in a totally different context here in this talk and in this work. Okay, so besides previous work, I have also to give a credit to Adán Cavello, Matthias Kleinmann, and Markus Müller, with whom we have an FQXI project on trying to reconstruct quantum theory from ideas that are close to the ideas of cubism and the idea of agents that have to cope with a very chaotic world around themselves and have to find the best way to make bets. And one idea that my colleagues were pushing strong for was this idea that we should think of the agents as like acting in an undifferentiated world where you get data from here and there, but they are not divided in data coming from one system or another. So the idea is there we have all this data together as a single block, and then we start to identify subsystems afterwards. And the idea here is that the different agents will use the theory in different ways and for their purposes will choose to cut the system in one way or another, depending on their own necessities. So we discussed it a lot. We had very heated discussions in Hong Kong when we wanted to do this on whether we should start by assuming composition. This is what I was advocating. And whether one should do what I'm doing now in the talk, or whether one should take a single system together, quote unquote, the universe all together, and then start to partition the universe into subsystems. I was strongly advocating against doing things in this way because I saw the benefits that we had in foundations of taking composition from the beginning. In a sense, this talk is an exercise of taking the point of view of your colleagues and see how far you can go. So I kind of embraced their point of view, temporarily at least, and I wanted to see how far we could go and work out some explicit examples. So this is why part of the where some of the motivation came, and I think I would not have embarked into this work if we didn't have so many discussions on this perspective of whether we should start from composition as fundamental or whether we should take all the data together and then define the subsystems. Okay, so end of the introduction. We can now start with the actual content of the talk. The structure of the talk is going to be very simple. There will be a very simple, well, deceptively simple definition, something that looks what obviously you should do, and many concrete examples that show you that at this level of generality, such a simple definition can bring pretty strange examples. And I will not comment during the talk on what this means. I will leave this to the discussion. So I will keep pretty much the talk on the technical level of trying to explain to you the construction and the results in the simplest possible way. And then for the discussion, we can kind of try to decide what this means and how much one can go forward in this direction. So let's do the framework. Framework is just very simple. I feel almost ashamed to call it a framework. It's like the bare bone thing that you could have in a physical theory. So the ingredients are the fact that you have a system. For you, for us, this will be our universe, not the universe, but is our universe, the thing that we will care about for this theory. Our universe of discourse, as people say in logic. So we have one system. This system will have a set of states, ST of S. And the set of states is a generic set without any structure, no convexity, no operators, no matrices, no structure at all. It is a purely set theoretic structure. It is a set containing elements, and they are called the states of the system. There will be a set of transformations, the transformations of S. These are the physical transformation. To be transformation, they should be closed under composition. You can apply a transformation first and have another transformation going after. And there will be the idea of, there is an identity transformation that means that there is no evolution happening on the system. For those who like the mathematical terms, this would be a monoid. Yes, please.
So I know it's very there. Sorry to ask. Yes. But are you thinking of the sets as being instantaneous states of the system?
Yes. I mean, I'm not attaching too much physical imaginary of this, but if we want to fix ideas, let's think of this really as a paradigm of mechanics or dynamical systems. There is a set of states of the system, and at every step in time, the system will be in one of these points of the set, and the evolution will tell you what is the next step. the next state. So the structure of the transformation is just the structure of a monoid, you can compose them, and the transformation max act on states. So there is a clear notion of what it means when I say I apply the transformation T to the state psi. So this is part of the framework and nothing more. Notice that there are no measurements here. There are no measurements because I will not need to talk about them. So if you like to think that this theory is also an operational theory with measurements, feel free to do that. There is nothing against doing that in this framework. It's just that I'm not going to use measurements in the whole talk, so I didn't want to overload the slide with more content, or even the paper that you see on the archive. So no measurements here, so, and if you are against measurement, well, you can feel free to be excited about the fact that there are no measurements here, but there is no structural reason why I didn't put the measurement. It's just that we only talk about this basic framework. Okay, so we can interpret this framework in these two ways. One is the kind of objective realist interpretation that the states and the transformations are really the possible states and the possible dynamics of the physical system. Somehow they represent the world as it is, so like without any reference to observers. So this is a kind of strong kind of objective interpretation. And the other option that is I'm kind of more sympathetic to, but again, the framework doesn't distinguish, is the option that you think more of these states and these transformations as the kind of beliefs of the theoretician about how the world will work if an experiment had to be done later. So it could be, this would be the beliefs about the possible states of the system and the beliefs about the possible evolutions that we can have. So what I will say is independent of which interpretation you choose. Okay, now let's put the agents in the picture. So far we had this kind of very generic picture, no agents there, it was just a catalog of things that could be and could happen. So now let's introduce the role of the agent. Here, the agent is just a glorified word to say that we have a set of transformations. For me, an agent will be barely described by this set. It's a set of transformations, it's a subset of the physical transformations, and they represent the action of the agent on the system. So action of A on the system X. I assume here that the actions are a monoid. That's not really essential, but it's kind of neat to do that. So the agent is just represented by the set of actions he or she can do, and this is somehow complementary to what Marcus was doing, where the agent was represented by what he knew, by the information content of the agent. Here, there is no information content of the agent, there is purely operations, purely actions that the agent can do. The important notion here is the notion of adversary. So you are an agent, you can do a certain set of operations, and now you want to ask, okay, I'm living in this world described by this theory, so what can other agents do around me? So what, imagine that I will use this theory to play a game, to do a sort of, I don't know, to play a Bayesian game or any sort of game. So I would like to model my adversary and to have an idea of what can happen, what moves my adversary can do against me by acting on his part of the world. So that's why we need the notion of subsystem. So we need somehow to flesh out the idea that there is a part of the world that is outside my control, and it is outside my lab, it is in someone else's hands, and this someone else could be an adversary of mine. So mathematically, I would model this by saying that the adversary is another agent that has a set of operations commuting with my operations. Okay? Oh, well, the operation of the agent we are considering. So there is agent A, let's say Alice, and the adversary Bob will be another agent that can do operations that commute with Alice's operations. This is deceptively simple because it really seems that this is what we should absolutely do. This is what it is almost obvious that we should do that. If you think carefully, it's not that obvious why acting on a different part of the world should mean commutativity, unless you already have in mind that you describe actions in terms of composite systems. But I will just postpone the discussion about this and take this as a mathematical definition. It's my mathematical modeling of what an adversary will be. Somebody whose actions commute with all the actions of the agent I'm considering.
Yep. So trans yep. A here is the act AS there.
Oh yes, sorry. Yeah. Yes, no, that's a typo. because probably I cut and pasted from the wrong. Yeah, this would be act AS and this would be act ABS.
Yeah.
So all the action of Alice commute with the actions of Bob. Okay, that's the idea. Thanks. I should remember to correct this part. Okay, so then there is the notion, if you want to play a game, you would like to give your adversary the maximum possible power. So you would consider the maximal adversary, the agent who can do all the operations that commute with your operations. So I will call this agent A prime, the maximal adversary of A, because prime was often used in algebraic framework to represent commutation. So the action of the agent A prime is really the commutator of the actions of the agent A. So that's why the reason of the prime. This is the canonical notation to say that you take a set of operation, a set of maps, and you take the commutant of that. So that's by definition what I'm considering. So this means that we will look at the most powerful adversary compatible with the idea that the actions of the adversary should commute with the action of the agent. Okay?
So you're thinking of the adversary here as the rest of the universe.
The rest of the universe is against me. It's a little bit of a paranoid perspective to think that the whole rest, you have a small lab and the whole rest of the universe is conspiring to make your life hard. And this is what I'm doing here, yes. So there is a caveat. As I said, this thing of looking at the commutant looks deceptively similar to what we have always done in quantum theory, when we have an algebra of observables and we take the commutant of that algebra. This is actually the way that von Neumann algebras are defined, that you can define them as sister algebras that are commutators of other sister algebras, that are the commutant of other sister algebras. So it looks the same, but it's not. Because here we are not talking about, if we were to do this in quantum theory, in standard quantum theory, we were not being talking about commutators of operators. We would talk about commutators of completely positive trace preserving maps. So commutators of quantum channels. And as far as I know, I haven't seen this appearing anywhere before the work of Lydia, Renato, and Leah. So I think that this, in a sense, we should be really careful not to easily identify this construction with the usual construction where you take the commutators of the operators. Here we are really doing the commutators of the maps. Okay, so let's use this to construct the subsystems. So we want to define what is the subsystem belonging to agent A. We have to define the degrees of freedom that are only accessible to Alice. By which I mean the degrees of freedom that are inaccessible to the adversary of A. So I will call the subsystem SA, and the job we have to do in the next slides is to define what are the states of this subsystem and what are the transformations of this subsystem. So I want to define this subsystem as a system like the one I had at the beginning, with the set of states and the set of transformations. Yes?
Quick question about the previous slide. Is it clear that there's a difference between the maps and the operators? Like if I took the algebra of Krauss operators, the freedom of Krauss decomposition, could I not express commutation with maps in terms of commutations with a particular algebra of operators?
It depends on what you want to do. If you think of this, like mathematically, completely positive maps are linear maps. So you can represent them as matrices. So in that sense, it is the same. In another sense, it is not the same because you don't get the same subsystems you used to get if you were to do this construction with the linear operators on the Hilbert space. So these are like two different linear spaces. We have been used to do the operation on one linear space. If you do it on the other, well, it is still commutator of linear operators or of linear operations, but you get a different result. You get different types of subsystems.
Would you be asking two different questions in that case? Like if I restricted myself to asking about, you know, on the Hilbert space, what unitaries could I do? Then it's sort of a question about Hilbert space. But if I'm at the level of the operator space, I gotta...
I'm going to show examples of this. So, but I'm saying that in the canonical operational approach to quantum theory, so the states are density matrices rho, the operations are quantum channels. If you do that, that's very unlike things that have been done before with operator algebras. But you can apply the framework to the usual scenario, yes. Okay, let's construct the subsystem. So the idea is that we intuitively should say that if you have two different states of the global system S, and the only difference between them is an operation performed by the adversary, the state corresponding only to the agent system should not have changed. Okay, so if a state has been changed by the adversary, we should identify the state with the previous one, and say that they are associated to the same state of the system of agent A. So at least if the state psi is equal to an action of the adversary applied to the state phi, we should identify phi and psi as states of system A, of the system belonging to the agent A, because the only thing that changes between one state and the other are operations that are done intuitively outside the lab of A. So if we want to define the states of system A, we should these two states should have the same states on A side, because the only B has changed. That's the intuition. So you can define the degraded version of a state psi as what you get by acting with the actions of the adversary. So you can think of the adversary as the opposite of King Midas. Whatever the adversary touches, instead of turning into gold, becomes less valuable. So it is degraded. Yes, you are free to smile. So the action of the adversary will degrade the state, and I define the degraded version of the state psi to this set. It's the orbit of the state psi under the action of the adversarial of the adversary.
So of course, you're not thinking here of the maximal adversary. Just
That's a good point. The definition could be applied to any adversary, but I will think of the maximal adversary later. Later, like in one slide from now. Yes, so this applies to any adversary, but I eventually I will use it for the biggest possible adversary that I can find. So there is this set, and now an observation is that if you have two sets, if you degrade a state phi and you degrade a state psi, and there is an intersection, by definition, by the argument I said before, all these two sets should correspond to the same state of system A. Okay? It's like, graphically, you can think of here that you have the states of the whole system. You partition them into degradation of sets. So whenever two states are in the same set, they should be colored with the same color, saying that they belong to the same state of the subsystem A. So what will happen is that this must be of the same color, but now this and this have an intersection, so this also should be of the same color, and this and this have an intersection, and so on. So in the end, all these states should correspond to the same local state of the local subsystem associated to the agent A, okay? So that's the construction. That's the way we can define the states of the subsystem, by kind of identifying operations that differ only by actions of the adversary. And we can do this to define an equivalence classes of state under this relation that, the technical details of the relation are just what this picture was saying. You say that phi is equivalent to psi if there is a way to get from phi to psi with non-trivial intersections. Okay? So if you accept this picture, you don't need to read the mathematical definition. It's just saying what the picture says. So this definition is not new. This was in the work, at least in the work by Leah and Lydia. Maybe it was also in works before that, but I think it's explicit in this one. And it was called the convergence through a monoid. So that's pretty much the same, that's exactly the same equivalence relation. The only thing that I should stress here is that now I'm taking the maximal adversary. So I'm doing a particular choice of how I want to use that relation that Lydia and Leah proposed. So I will quotient with respect to the maximal adversary that the agent has. And in this way, I will define the states of the system. So one can also extend this idea to the transformations. We can say that two transformations acting on the global system are one degraded version of the other, is they are of this, if one is of this form, is obtained by first applying an operation of the adversary, then applying the operation you cared about, and then again an operation of the adversary. So the adversary will degrade your operations, and you can take again the degraded sets, and you can do the same construction we did for states to define the transformations of the system. So you'll have again an equivalence relation where you say that one transformation is equivalent to another if there is a path of degradations that connects one to the other, in the same way I did with the states. So you can use this to define the transformations of the subsystem. Well, you have to be a little bit subtler here. Because you shouldn't do this with every transformation of the global system. You should already start with transformations that are good candidates for acting locally only on A's system. So a good candidate would be all the transformation that commutes with the actions of the adversary. So here we'll take the double commutant of the original set of actions. So the commutant of what an agent can do is what the adversary can do. The commutant of what the adversary can do is the space of transformation that acts only on the agent system. Okay? It could be bigger than the set we started from, meaning that the original agent didn't have the full power to do every possible operation in the initial system. But this is kind of a reasonable candidate for the operations that we can do on the local system of agent A. So we can define the transformation of the subsystem as equivalence classes under the degradation relation that I showed before of the transformation you can do on system A. The transformation that are in the double commutant. Yes?
I don't know if we'll get into this in the example. So one of the things we were thinking about mm-hmm. when we developed this mm-hmm. is that you could think of a theory that where all the transformations are just unitaries in a larger system, mm-hmm. but then it could recover the effect on a subsystem to be like maps, like adding noise, for example.
Yes.
Doesn't this exclude this from the fact that you start only with...
I wouldn't know on the top of my head. I would need to process a little bit the information you gave me and to. Maybe I would need more time than the one I have here in order to think about. But we will have lots of examples if I get to that, and that would probably clarify what these definitions are. Oh, here they are. So here is the first example. The first example is the trivial one. Is a sanity check. It's like when you have a bipartite quantum system, tensor product of Hilbert spaces, at least you would like this definition to recover what we knew and loved to be the quantum subsystem. So I have a global Hilbert space that is the product of Hilbert spaces of Ellis and Bob. The states are the density matrices, the full set of density matrices on the joint Hilbert space. And the transformation is the full set of completely positive trace-preserving maps on this set. So this defines what is the space of possibilities that we are considering. Now, let's introduce the agent. The agent Alice would be the agent that applies quantum channels, completely positive trace-preserving maps, only on the A subsystem, only on the Hilbert space HA. So we'll have maps acting only on one factor of the tensor product and the identity channel on the other side. This is our monoid of possible actions. If you wanted to now to see what is the maximal adversary, so this is actually the maximal one, the commutant, you find out that if you use the definition, the commutant is exactly the operation that would act on the Bob's part of the system. And clearly, the double commutant would be again what we had before, because if this is true, you can just exchange A and B and get that result. So the commutant, the adversary, is Bob. So there is Alice here, Bob there. Bob is the adversary. If you do the quotient, you really do get that the states of the subsystem SA are exactly the density matrices defined on the Hilbert space HA. And you get that the transformations of the subsystem are exactly the quantum channels acting only on the subsystem HA. So I'm not doing it explicitly, but it takes a couple of minutes to check it. There is no complicated the thing to check. So this was a sanity check, just to say that if we take this broad and general definition, in the case that we know, we get what we had to get. Let me give you another example. This is kind of less standard. So now we take a subsystem of a single quantum system, according to the definition. That's possible, because we just define subsystems in terms of subsets of operations. So here you have a system described by a Hilbert space, and you take just the vector space formulation. So the state of the system would be a vector psi, is a superposition of vectors of the computational basis. The transformations are unitary gates now on that system, all possible unitaries. This defines the global system. Now let's say that the agent can only apply diagonal unitaries. So the agent can only apply unitaries that are diagonal in the computational basis. So what do you get from this? If you look at that, the adversary happened to be the same, to have the same operations as the agents. So the only operators that commute with all the diagonal unitaries are again the diagonal unitaries themselves. So the agent and the adversary have access to the very same set of operations, which means that the agent is not going to be able to do much without touching the territory of the adversary. So what you get here is that the subsystem associated to this particular agent is the set of diagonal density matrices. So the incoherent mixtures of states in the computational basis are the states of the system. The transformations that the agent can do on her own subsystem are just the identity, because everything is quotient by the same set of transformations. So there is basically nothing that the agent can do except just leaving the system there. So this is an example, a more exotic and more non-standard application of the general definition. So you start to see that the definition seems very natural, it seems the obvious thing to do, but there are some strange things that start to happen, and they will show more strange things also. Okay? So but the nice thing of this example is that shows you that somehow you can think of incoherent mixtures as the local states of a single quantum system where the global states are pure superpositions. So coherence and incoherence can be seen as the difference between a global system and a subsystem. Now, there is a more standard version of the same example if you want to see the classical subsystems of a quantum system. So imagine that your global system is the full quantum system with all the density matrices on a certain Hilbert space and all the quantum channels, all the completely positive trace-preserving maps on that space. Now, to the agent, I would allow to do all the operations that are called phase-covariant channels. Physically, this would mean all the operations that the agent can do without having a phase reference for the computational basis. So I will take diagonal unitary gates, turn them into channels, and I will allow to the agent to apply all the operations that commute with these diagonal unitaries. So the interpretation here again is that Alice will lack a phase reference in her lab, so her operations should be independent of this phase reference. This is something that appeared a lot in the theory of quantum reference frames. I think it's one of the canonical examples of what you can do, especially in the theory actually of asymmetry. This will be a symmetric operation. Okay, this is what we allow to the agent. The interesting thing is to characterize the commutant of the agent. What you find is that the commutant of the phase covariant channels are those channels that preserve the computational basis. So that will require more work than the things I showed before. There is a bit of work to be done to show this theorem. So eventually, what you find out is that the phase covariant channel are the commutant of the basis on preserving channels and vice versa. So these two sets are one the commutant of the other. But again, these are sets of channels. These are not anymore sets of operators on the Hilbert space. They are super operators on the density matrices. Okay, so if you do that, what are you going to get? Well, the heuristics is that if you have an agent and the agent has no phase reference, he will only have access to a classical system because the phases, the coherences will disappear and the agent will only have in his hand, well, her hand in this case, a classical system. And indeed, this is what we find, that the states of the subsystem A are actually probability distributions on a set of dimension D, and the transformations that you can do are exactly the classical channels, so the Markov map processes, the conditional probability distribution that given a state will let you jump to another classical state of the system with some probability. So this is what the construction does. And well, this is good. This is one of the good examples. It's one of the one I like, because you can see really that the classical systems are coherently interpreted as subsystems of quantum systems according to this broader definition. Okay. Enough for the examples for a moment. Now let me say a little bit of properties that we get here. So there are some obvious things that you can do with the definitions. One is these purely a kind of formal definitions. If you take the maximal adversary and you call it B, you can call the operation of taking equivalence class the partial trace. Why? Just because you want to do that. There is no particular reason. That's just a definition of what you mean by this partial trace. You take the equivalence class under the relation I defined before. Well, let's do it. If we do that, well, first, sorry. If you do that, first of all, in the canonical example of quantum theory, you get the partial trace. So this says that this choice of notation is not stupid, because you do get the partial trace in the case where this should be the partial trace. But the interesting and, well, the interesting but trivial fact is that by definition, you will get the no signaling property, because you defined this partial trace to be the equivalence class under the operation of the adversary. So of course, after you apply an operation of the adversary, you are still in the same equivalence class. This is how we built the equivalence classes. So you have that whatever the adversary is doing will not change the state of the system. Again, trivially, because we built things in this way. But it's kind of nice conceptually to think that this clarifies a little bit the role of no-signaling. Typically, no-signaling has been associated to spatial separation. And people ask a question about how can you retrieve the zero-sum bound principle about distant agents, how distant agents could communicate. But actually, in this framework, no-signaling is not much related to spatial separation, but purely to the definition of subsystems through operations. And I like this very much because like things like the zero-sum bound apply even to systems that are not spatially separated, even to different degrees of freedom that are localized on the same system, like the polarization and the path of a photon. So you can have these sort of things. And basically, you think that the tensor product structure and all that comes with that is more related to the operations we use to define subsystems than to the way that systems are distributed in space. Yep.
Could you remind me what an adversary, what it means for it to be maximal?
Oh, the full commutant of the operations of the agent. So I have the agent has a set of operations, and then I take everything that commutes with that, and I grant the adversary to use all these operations. So the adversarial operations are all those that commute with the operations of the agent.
Okay, so the maximal one is not just choosing one of them?
No. Choosing a particular one. So it's the partial trace over the rest of the universe, so to speak. Okay, so now I can use, a bit late, but I can use the remaining time to talk about the part of the title of my talk that was about the conservation of information. So it's now making things a little bit more specific and going a little bit perhaps in the direction of what Lydia was saying about talking about only pure states and reversible dynamics. So what is the conservation of information? Well, informally, this is the idea that we can always reconstruct the past from the future of a system. Okay? This is informal. So this idea was strongly advocated by Susskind, also by Busso, by people working on the black hole information paradox. There are also a lot of educational videos you can find by Susskind talking about a very basic presentation of this principle of conservation of information. Here is an example. So it's the idea that if these are the states of the system at one step in time, the evolution could bring you here. And here, if you see, the only thing that happened is that I swapped red with blue. So this is from the state of the system at the next step. You can always reconstruct what was the state of the system at the previous step. So more formally, we can try to specify what we mean by conservation of information. You can say that a transformation, a physical transformation, is logically invertible if defines an injective function on the state space of the system. So if you have an injecting map from the possible state at one step and the possible state at the next step, I would say that this is a logically invertible process. A stronger property is the property of physical invertibility. You could have that not only you have a logically invertible map, a kind of injective map of the states in the present to the states in the future, but you could also have a physical process that brings you back to the original state. So you say that the transformation is physically invertible if there is another physical transformation, the inverse, that brings you back. And so when you compose the two together, you get the identity on the system. Right? So these two definitions are slightly different. Well, perhaps not slightly, they are different. So you can find, if you specify what you consider, there are cases of operations that are logically invertible, but not physically invertible. For example, if you consider pure quantum mechanics with pure evolutions, and if you are in infinite dimension, if you shift a Fock state n to Fock state n plus 1, you have an injective map on the states of the system. Every state at the next step can be recovered from what you had before, but this map is not physically invertible in pure state quantum mechanics. There is no other isometry that would bring you back. So this, especially in infinite dimension, these two are very different things. Okay, so what is the conservation of information? The conservation of information, we say that the system satisfies this property if all the physical transformations are invertible, either logically or physically. So we have two different ways of formulating the conservation of information. And the nicest one is the physical conservation of information, so I will stick to that in the next slides. So there is a fact. A fact is that if you assume the physical conservation of information, if you assume that every evolution is invertible, you get that all the transformations form a group. So that in a sense you would get that in quantum theory, if you only consider isometries and you want all them to be invertible in your set of physical transformations, it means you are only considering unitaries, not just isometries. So you get this, that the transformations form a group, and this is the case that I will care about in the next few slides. So we can now define subsystems with our old definition. We can specialize the old definition to the case we are considering now. So our agent will be able to perform a subgroup of the group of all physical transformations. So there will be the subgroup of operations that Alice can perform on her system. And the action of the adversary would be another group that is the commutant of the group of Alice's transformation. Again, I consider all these reversible transformations that commute with those of Alice. So I have the commutant group. Everything is a group now because we have the physical conservation of information. Yes? Oh, sorry. Yes, so we do that. If we do that, our equivalence relationships, the one that I showed before, take a much nicer and much simpler form. So instead of doing this complicated thing of doing the sets, the intersection, the path, and all that, you can say that a state phi is equivalent to a state psi if and only if there is a reversible transformation done by the adversary that changes one state into the other. So this is what you are familiar with in quantum mechanics. When you have pure states, you have two purifications of the same local state of Alice, and there is always one way to go from one purification to the other by applying a local unitary operation on the other system that would be what belongs to the adversary here. And well, as some of you know very well, this plays an important role in bit commitment, where really the other system is the adversary, because the two players, A and B, are fighting each other and they're trying to achieve opposite goals. So this somehow justifies a posteriori the choice of the name adversary, at least. So you can do the same for transformations, and again, the equivalence relation becomes very simple. No complicated thing with the degradation sets. You say that two transformations are equivalent if and only if you obtain one from the other by sandwiching the other between reversible operations of the adversary. So this is the point of contact with the world of Gilles Brassard and Raymond and Paul Raymond Robichaud. I mean, for totally different reasons, they consider the relation, they defined their states, the states of the agents, through this relation without the part before the evolution. So the same structure played an important role there as well. Okay, so we have our definition of subsystems, we have everything. Okay, I think I have like 5 minutes more, and I will use, So I will use that to give you a few more examples and to finish with them. The examples are examples of Lie groups in quantum mechanics. So let's work out what the definition gives us for Lie groups. Compact Lie groups, because they are easier. So I take a quantum system with only pure states now, only rank one projectors as the states. Transformations are only the unitary channels acting on the systems, so the things of the form density matrix rho going to u rho u dagger. And now the agent will be able to perform all the unitary channels that belong to a group representation. So we will have a certain compact group G represented on the Hilbert space by unitary operators u of g. So for every element of the group G, there will be a unitary operator u of g, and we grant the agent the ability to perform every unitary channel corresponding to these unitary operators. Okay, so this is what the agent can do. So we need to now to characterize the adversary. We use an equation that has been very common in the study of quantum reference frames and asymmetry, is the isotypic decomposition of the group representation. So you can always decompose every group representation into block diagonal form, where the blocks are labeled by the reducible representations of the group. And within each block, you have a tensor product structure. You have the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces, and you have operators acting on these two. On one hand, you get the action of the group that is irreducible. On the other hand, you have a multiplicity space where the group acts trivially, so there is no action at all. So if you want to compute the commutant of the unitary operators here, it's easy, and you will get well, unitary operators of the same block diagonal form, but where now you are acting on the other tensor factor in the product for every reducible representation. So this is a canonical result in mathematical physics. The commutant of an algebra in general is the algebra of operators of this form. Okay? So operators that act only on the multiplicity space and do nothing on the irreducible spaces of the group. So the natural thing is to think that what the adversary can do are the channels associated to these unitary gates. This is not always true, in fact. But it is true if your group is connected. So if you have a connected Lie group, then the commutant of the group of unitary channels that the agent can do are really the unitary channels corresponding to the commuting unitary operators that you have there. So this is what you get this is the easy case. If you do that, you have what you would expect. And your states are just the block diagonal density matrices where you have, with some probability Pj, you will have a density matrix in the representation space of the group. So these are block diagonal density matrices. It's interesting to see that this convex set of density, this set of density matrices is not convex unless the dimension of the multiplicity spaces is big enough. Because here you need matrices of a rank that is smaller than the minimum dimension between the dimension of the representation space and the multiplicity space. This is basically what the Schmidt decomposition will tell you. So this set of density matrices is not going to be convex unless you have a large enough multiplicity space. So this is something that should already make you careful on the fact on how this definition is really doing what you want it to do. If you look at the transformations, they look good. They are really like block diagonal channels where in each block you apply a unitary gate. Okay, that was the nice example. Let me give you a nasty example. And this is the simplest nasty example you can think of. Imagine an agent that acts on a qubit and can only flip the phase of the qubit. So your states are pure states of a qubit. Your physical transformations are unitary channels, changing the state of the qubit. Now, to the agent, you allow only two things, either to do nothing or to apply the sigma z, the Pauli z channel, so to apply to the density matrix sigma z, rho sigma z. So the monoid of actions contains only two elements, identity and sigma z. Sigma z squared is sigma z again, so you only have this. Good, so if you run the construction, you find that the commutant of these channels is the union of two sets. One set is what you expected, so you'll have unitary gates that are diagonal in the computational basis. They all commute with sigma z. The other set of unitary channels you find are the same as this, so are unitaries that are diagonal, after which you flip zero with one. You add the bit flip in the end. Also these things, if you look at the channels, they commute with the Pauli channel that applies the Pauli gate sigma z. So this is kind of a weirder example. And in this example, if you use the construction that I showed you, you find that the state space is a circle. So it's not a set of, so it's not convex, it's a convex set. It's not even a set of density matrices. It's just one parameter telling in which point of the circle you are, and the transformations are only the identity. So this is a pretty nasty example that tells you that this construction is so broad that you even get things that you may not have wanted to see. I think my time should be up now, isn't it? I mean, I have one more example, but we can leave it for later, or I can go over it quickly to tell you that it exists, and if anybody is interested, we can go over it later. This is kind of a more complex version of what I was already doing. If you take a compact Lie group, again, you take the pure states and the unitary channels, you allow the agent to perform every unitary channel in the representation of the group. So now let's try to work out the problem in full generality. You can prove a theorem that says that the actions of the adversary are the semi-direct product of two groups. One is the group of the commuting unitaries, the one that everybody would have expected, so the commuting part. The other is a finite group, or is a discrete group, is abelian, and is a subset of the permutation groups of the reps that you have. So it's a very interesting mathematical structure that you get. You get the product of the commutator group with the permutations, with an abelian subgroup of the permutation of their reps. And this is what the bit flip was doing in the previous example. It was in that example, the subgroup was just a bit flip and identity. So if you quotient, if you construct the states of the subsystems, you get that the states are not anymore a set of density matrices. They are vectors made of density matrices with a probabilistic weight in front. And the labels of the vectors, the entries of the label of the vectors are labeled by reducible representations. So you get this vector of density matrices, and all this, and this vector is quotiented by permutations in a certain group of permutations of the entries of the vector. So that's a very weird thing, something that you may not have wanted to see, and eventually you find here. And the transformations are pretty much the same. They are transformations of the components of this vector, quotiented by the action of the permutations. So you get pretty strange stuff. And this is like the last example I wanted to show. I had one more thing to say, that is that I will not go over the slides. Let me basically stop here. So the other thing I wanted to say is that, of course, in what I just did, if you start from pure states and you define subsystems in this way, you get purification for free. Because whatever state of the subsystem you will define, by definition, comes from a pure state of the system, if you are able to say what you mean by pure state. And I will skip on over that. I mean, if you want, you can ask me later what I mean. But provided that you can do that, you can restrict yourself to the pure state. You can say every state of a subsystem comes from a pure state of the larger system. And by definition, this pure state is almost unique, because the only difference between two purification will be an operation done by the adversary, because that's how we constructed the subsystem. So in a sense, the purification axiom that was so powerful in our derivation of quantum theory becomes is kind of reabsorbed by the definition, provided that you want to go this far and have this broader definition and accept that there are pretty weird examples that arise. So up to you whether you want to do it or not. So end of the talk. Here are a summary of the conclusion. We have an operational construction of the subsystems, where you start from the operations, you take the commutant, and you quotient. So this gives you the usual subsystems, but it gives you also a lot of weird stuff that you may not have wanted to see. And the other part on which I really glossed now was that if you start from the conservation of information, if you have only reversible states, and you have something that allows you to talk about pure states, that's the part I skipped, this idea of cyclic state, then you would get purification. So that's all. Thank you very much for your attention and for the opportunity to present this new work today. Thanks.
Questions? Yeah. So I had a question about your examples. Yeah. Because you really so you showed you could have composite systems and embedded classical systems, but presumably you could have embedded quantum systems quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that you did 5 minutes of Q-trip, have a block diagonal decomposition to SU2 on one block, which is Alice.
Yes,
and
yes.
In the opposite corner, you take the equivalence class.
Well, you don't get exactly the qubit as a subsystem. You get as a subsystem a hybrid system made of a classical system that it tells you either you are in the state ket 0 or in a qubit done by ket 1 and ket 2. So yes, in that sense, you get the qubit as possible states of the subsystem. Yes. Yes. So all these things that we liked, the things about basically block diagonal algebras, can be retrieved here if you choose the right operations for the agent. So all things that we knew are still here. The thing is that the definition is so basic and so broad. Basic and broad come together, because if you do something very basic, you don't specify much about the structure. So this is so broad that you also get these very strange examples. And this is open to debate whether this means that we need to find more principle and to put more structure here in order to single out nice subsystems that we like, or whether it is a feature that we have these strange subsystems and this is really something that could be useful. I really don't have an opinion on that, but it's kind of interesting, at least from the point of view of zoology, to have the opportunity to see these weird beasts, basically. Yep.
Yes, just to comment. So I think if you include measurements, which you might not want to, then you can decide if, you know, it's a valid choice to join the
group. No, it's not that I don't want to. As I said at the beginning, one may want to introduce measurements, but as you see, I almost went over time just saying the few things that came out from just having states and transformations. I originally was planning to write about subsystems in the paper, and when the paper became 34 pages long, I decided that this could be another follow-up work on which I would embark later in the future. Things were, again, more complicated than I thought before when I thought I will work on this and write down my ideas in a simple paper so that I have it written somewhere. Like what. So eventually, if you really dig into these things, they turn out to be way more subtle and way thornier than we would expect. That's probably the main message of the talk itself. I think Lydia can probably comment also on this.
It's like the last chapter of my thesis, and then 2 years later we still didn't...
Of your thesis?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that. I mean, I thought it was Leah's thesis. Yes. But you say in your thesis already you are talking about this thing.
Yeah, so
I didn't know that.
Subsystems and then couldn't get anywhere.
Yes. I mean, the thing that makes the work a little bit difficult is that the fact that we have a freedom of choice. We have to decide how far we go, no? Like how much general is good and how much, I mean, the same is general probabilistic theories, no? There has been an excitement in doing things that are so general and so much more general than quantum theory. And then after a few years, we found out that if you want to do interesting things with the general probabilistic theories, we don't really care about general probabilistic theories. We care about probabilistic theories that satisfy some extra axioms that give us enough structure to do stuff. And I think, again, many people in the audience have experience with that. You see that you need axioms and features of the systems that are powerful enough that they give you a good structure. It's not this. One should not just be eager for generality. Generality is not a bonus per se. Generality is good when it helps us understanding things. If you become so general that you just say 0 = 0, that's the equation of the universe, A equal to zero, or things like that. I mean, it's too general at some level. And here my doubt is that maybe this construction itself is too general, and one really needs to add more structure to say, we need to have more structure in order to be able to say something nicer and simpler than what I was saying just now. Yeah. Yeah.
So in that vein, I was wondering if you could have a sort of no-restriction hypothesis where a set of operations equals its double commutator.
Yes.
It seemed like in quantum theory this was satisfied.
Yes. I mean, in the paper, I actually wrote down things about this. So a kind of nicer example is when the agent you start from has already full power on her own subsystem, which is the case where the set is equal to its double commutant. So in this case, the agent and the adversary form a dual pair because the agent is also the most powerful adversary of the adversary. So that's the kind of fair situation. So definitely for axiomatic purposes, if I wanted really to use this idea to have an axiomatic derivation of quantum theory, that was the motivation of my co-authors to think, okay, I take the point of view of cubism, I imagine that I am an agent, I make a model of things that I want to bet on, whatever the model is, the theory should not tell me how I make the model, just tell me I do that, and now I think of myself playing against an adversary, imagine that we have a game, and now to use some sort of fairness principle to say that I am not special, I mean... The adversary, I could be the adversary of my adversary, so he is in the same position as me, and then this would force the double commutant. But this is not going to save us from weird examples. So like the example, the most horrible example I showed in the end is an example with that feature.
Nice.
The two sets are one, the double commutant of the other. Another algebraic condition, so is one thing that I like in this project is that somehow we just follow old constructions that have been studied by algebraic quantum field theorists or like by people in quantum information and error correction. But we do the very same thing, except that now it means a different thing. So another idea that was done, that was considered before, is to say that you have an algebra of observables at the time, an algebra that has trivial center. So the intersection between the commutant and the set of actions is just the identity. So that condition also is kind of relevant here. And you may want to ask for that condition to be true. Like this would remove the cases where you have a direct sum. It would single out the case where you really have the tensor product of Alice and Bob.
Yeah.
If you have a direct sum, all the phases are in common. The phases between the blocks are in common between Alice and Bob. If you ask that there is nothing in common between the agent and the adversary, you find a nicer situation. But still, even that, I think, does not remove pathological examples. If you take two agents, that are both the, like the dual of each other and have now no operations in common, even that doesn't give you all the things you would like to be true. Again, I could have added way more slides than one I had, but as you see, just talking about these very basic things took us more than an hour. But just to say, I mean, things like basic things. If I have a total system, let's say that I can do everything. I can do every possible operation. So my adversary can only do the things that commute with every operation. Let's say that that's trivial. That's only the identity. Let's run this construction. Is it true that I get the same system I started from? Well, it is true. Sorry, in this case, it is true if we guarantee that the adversary has no operation in common with us, so the center is trivial. Let's do the opposite. Let's say that I can do nothing and my adversary can do everything. Is it true that my system is trivial? Well, no, not from any of the axioms that I showed so far. So you would like to say that if my adversary can do everything on the system, my system is the part of the system that belongs to me is trivial. Well, that's not guaranteed by the definition. So there are many things that you would expect to be true, but they are not true. This would be guaranteed if we had this thing of the cyclic state that I didn't explain for reasons of time. But again, that's an extra requirement. So it really feels that we are going, it's beautiful to be general and simple, but also at some point one has to put back some restrictions that tells us that we are not considering any generic theory, but we are doing something more specific. Yadori?
Could you say a bit more about why you're happy that no signaling comes out as a trivial consequence of your definitions?
Yes. So partly for maybe idiosyncratic reasons. So the reason is that usually people would talk about no signaling and associate this with the special relativity, no? And somehow, at least as a matter of taste, I was not very happy of doing foundations of quantum theory and being so precise about what axiom we take in, and then you take on board something that comes from another physical theory for free, as though this was like, it's no problem. No, we are so careful that we put only axioms of, the pure states can be connected by operation. Okay, we have to declare that. This is an axiom. And at some point you say, oh, look, there is another physical theory hanging out there. Or in that theory, it so happens that spatially separated systems cannot signal from each other. And then, of course, I could have this requirement here in this one, this attempt to derive quantum theory. I found that, at least aesthetically, it was not matching the idea of what I meant by foundation. Right? If you do foundation, you can try to have to start really from things that you believe that should be true per se, and not because there is some corner of theoretical physics that suggests and hints that things should be in a certain way. So that was perhaps a personal reason. But a more serious reason is the one that I mentioned before, is that if you think of properties that come from, well, even the property of no signaling is a property of composite systems. Like if you have system A tensor system B in quantum mechanics, you have the composite states, operations of B will not signal on operation on A. This bipartition does not necessarily have anything to do with space-like separation. The 2 degrees of freedom could be the polarization of a photon and the path of the same photon. Or, I don't know, it could be the spin of an electron and the orbital momentum of the same electron. So by what means these are two spatially separated systems? And yet, they are 2 independent degrees of freedom. If you want to test Bell inequalities by doing operations on the spin and the orbital angular momentum of the same electron, you would find that the bound is 2√2. And you would not find something else because the two systems are not spatially separated. So it feels that if you want to understand something about how no signaling works, it has more to do with the way that the operations of local subsystems are combined together. It has more to do with that, with the distance between the two systems themselves. Also because, again, in this axiomatic level, when we think about state spaces, there is really nothing in the formalism that specifies the distance between two subsystems. So pretty much, that's another aesthetic reason, perhaps. Before I was aiming for axioms that were talking about subsystems irrespectively of how far they are from each other. So if I want no signaling, well, we had an axiom of causality in our axiomatization. And if you remember that, it's an axiom about a single system. System A satisfies causality. If every, depending on, if the choice of measurements that I'm going to do tomorrow on this system will not affect the probability of the preparations that I do today. This is not an axiom about, it's not like no signaling, it's not about composite system, it's an axiom about the single system. But if you apply this axiom in a context where you have two systems that are independent, you find out that they must satisfy no signaling. So in that sense, I was very satisfied with that approach because it was not invoking the distance between the systems, but it was a property of like one system per se, and then when you put them together, you would have no signaling as a consequence of this notion of causality. Of the choice of measurement doesn't influence the probability of the preparation of the same system. Yeah.
Right, well, maybe we should save the discussions for after the coffee break. So yep. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot for the attention and patience. Thank you.